applies. And I know that people that have lived in these worlds and gone back and forth are constantly feeling this. And so that if you can imagine growing up in a society of non-transactional time, where non-transactional time is the central value, and where transactional time is seen as kind of rude, it's a violation of the fundamental Arabic and Islamic virtue of adab, or kind of open-ended hospitality. If you can imagine living in that society for years, and all of a sudden either your city has been transformed into a kind of modern hyper-transactional time city, or you're ending up in some city in the West where you're working this way, and you're delighted to have all these opportunities at work and to build up some finances and get all the benefits of this industrialized world, and yet there's something missing, something lost, something profound. And I think the question is not just saying what is wrong, but saying how can industrialized societies and traditional societies, especially Islamic society with some of these deeply held and very richly articulated values, get together and share these values and contribute to one another so that we can have both economic progress and this kind of human warmth I was trying to mention. Very quickly, I'll just mention two others and then I would like to have some discussion. Up until recently, the Islamic world was a world in which poetry was absolutely central to life. One of the major entertainments in the Islamic world is people staying up all night with poetry contests. You know, you're expected to recite a poem from the classics. Then maybe someone else would recite another poem. Then you're expected to extemporize on the same meter and come up with a poem on the spot that'll play on this classical poem and also show your own originality. And this poetic culture is completely bound up with the topic of longing for the lost beloved. It's the central motif. It's called ghazal, G-H-A-Z-A-L. And this is the poetic tradition which had a profound impact on the troubadours and has really had an impact on the very origins of Western romantic poetry. In some sense, when we say we and they, Islam and the West, the West has got so much of Islam embedded in its very depth, and Islam has so much of the West, that those terms are a bit artificial. And this is a world of gentleness, of subtlety, of satire, of openness, of a play, of eroticism, of humor. And it's a world that most Americans do not associate with the face of Islam. In fact, when sometimes I'm sitting on an airplane or on a train or somewhere and I'm translating one of these poems or trying to translate it, someone will come up, a stewardess or somebody is sitting next to me and say, what are you doing? And I'm translating some classical Islamic poetry. And they'll look at it and they'll say, I never thought that Muslims would engage in that kind of stuff. And it is an absolute paradigm breaker. And yet this is a world that's alive, it's present, and it's a world that has so many of the kind of deeper, tender feelings, sensitive feelings, thoughtful feelings that are important to the culture, vital to the culture, and yet for various reasons, both because of the way some Islamic leaders present Islam, because the way the media has now only wanted to see that presentation of Islam as Islam, they don't believe other presentations are authoritative, and because of the politicized controversies in the last 50 years, and for other reasons, this area of incredible wealth and beauty is very, very little translated in the wider cultural sense. Most Americans have probably read some poetry of Rumi translated and Americanized by the translator Coleman Barks. And many people think, well, that's an exception. But as I mentioned, Rumi was just the tip of the iceberg. Finally, people say, what's the Quran all about? Is the Quran really, as people say, if you kill your enemy, then you'll get 70 virgins in heaven, as some of these constant absurdities come up. And of course, some people believe that, just as Timothy McVeigh had ideas about Christianity that I won't get into, but are equally amazing. But when one says, you know, what's the Quran about? It's almost always, what's its position on violence? And I think it's a very important question. And one of the things Bernard Lewis says, and this kind of judgment I think is so dangerous, he said, well, unlike other religions, Islam was founded by a prophet who is also a warrior, who is also a ruler. And then he draws several conclusions, meaning this means that there's an obligation built in within Islamic tradition that the Muslims should either convert or destroy all non-believers. And I think that's a dangerous step. I would say that it's very important to have a cross-cultural study of religion and violence. See how religion is used in violence. I was, as Marty mentioned, immersed in that in Bosnia. And I'd suggest that there are several areas one could look at. One, the whole notion of monotheism. There's only one God, therefore all other gods are false. Maybe they should be destroyed. A lot of thinkers are questioning, how can monotheism ever live in a world of many religions in a truly, deeply, profoundly tolerant way? And I think it's a major discussion now going on. The second is the divinely mandated holy war. So not only Muhammad fought divinely mandated holy wars, and not only Moses, but Joshua was ordered to carry out a divinely ordered genocide, exterminating the Canaanites, man, woman, and child. Then there is the Promised Land. Promised Land has been such a powerful metaphor for liberation in Passover Seders and in Martin Luther King's struggle for civil rights. And yet the same texts were used by those who enslaved South Africa. The Afrikaners had those texts in their hand. And when they and that was for them, they were this is their Promised Land. And were used by Christians for centuries when they occupied and took over areas in North America from the Indians. Even nonviolent passages can have extraordinary consequences. Of course, the crucifixion of Jesus has been at the center of the allegation that Jews are Christ killers and led to pogroms and persecutions up through the Holocaust. And in Bosnia, the Muslims were viewed as Christ killers because they were viewed as responsible for the death of Prince Lazar in the Battle of Kosovo in 1389, who in Serbian culture is a Christ figure, and this is called the Serbian Golgotha. And that mythology was systematically used by the Serbian religious nationalists during that genocide. Then if there's the issue of hell and heaven. If one believes that people are going to go to hell if they do or believe things that you don't believe in, then there's nothing you can possibly do to them that's not better for them than what will happen if you allow them to continue their acts as they are. And that was the logic behind the Inquisition, of course. And finally, there's the apocalyptic war that Mark Juergensmeyer has studied so well, where people see themselves as in a war between absolute good and evil. They use the book of the Apocalypse. And I watch this at night, in the middle of the night, on some of these TV stations, Christian right TV stations, and that people are living this apocalyptic war, and many of them are waiting for the war in the Middle East, hoping it will come quickly, because there's one brand of apocalyptic spirituality that believes Jesus will not return until there's a big war in the Middle East. But once one gets beyond the violence issue, why is the Quran meaningful to people? What touches them? This is the thing that's so hard to get at. This is where people come to me and say, you know, I went to the bookstore, Mike, and I picked up the Quran, and I got into about 13 pages or 14 pages, and I didn't know what was going on. It seemed cold, alien, aloof. And in many ways, I think that that reaction is almost inevitable if one just goes up and picks up the Quran and starts reading it in English from beginning to the end. That's not how Muslims usually learn the Quran. They usually start out learning the short chapters that were thought to have been revealed to Muhammad at first, which are in the very back of the written Quran, and which speak directly to humankind without all the Arabic place names and tribal names and warfare and issues that are some of the other surahs, and ask the human being, what is the meaning of your life? And in a very profound and deeply moving way. And just very briefly stated, when it's recited in Arabic, and most Muslims do not believe that the Quran exists outside of the Arabic recitation, when it's recited in Arabic, the Quran has a combination of majesty, of power, and of intimacy, as if God were both a God of majesty, but also a God of tenderness, speaking almost as if he were speaking, as the Quran says, closer to us than our own heart. And those two things coming together, I think, is why the Quran has that distinctive power. When Muhammad was asked, where's your miracle, if you're a prophet, Moses had a miracle, Jesus had a miracle, the answer in the Quran is this Quran is the miracle. And for people who hear it in the Arabic, that claim makes sense. The statement in the Quran is, if any human being can compose anything like it, try it. If you can do it, the Quran's a fraud. But if you look at it in English translations, it's hard to understand how that claim could be so compelling. So finding ways to bridge these translation gaps and to allow people to touch these deeper areas of human feeling, I think, is a way of reaching the humanity of human beings. And although these conflicts in Palestine and Iraq and Saudi Arabia are intractable in the political way, and that's important, it's really vital on the cultural and religious level to make these human bridges so that what are now very tragic wars don't turn into the kind of nightmare that some people believe already exists. And I'd like to end with this anecdote that relates to the wonderful announcement about the Islamic Studies program. One of the people that's been hailed recently as a prophet whose voice was not listened to is V.S. Naipaul, who's written several books on Islam, in which he criticizes Islam severely as a kind of religion of violence and fear. And at one point, he's talking about Fazlur Rahman, who is a professor at the University of Chicago, and he refers to him as a fundamentalist fanatic. And he says that this fundamentalist fanatic, Fazlur Rahman, claimed political asylum, got into the United States, got a visa, was allowed to teach at the United States and spew his hatred for years. Well, Fazlur Rahman was one of the most gentle human beings and most sincerely committed reformer I have ever met. He was my teacher for years at the University of Chicago. Many of the people who teach in Islamic studies today studied under him. His view of religion was generous. He was always involved with interreligious dialogue. He never said a harsh word about another religion. He never even entertained the idea of saying a harsh word about another religion. He was trying to find ways of interpreting the Quran in a way that validated its fact that it's the eternal word of God, and yet allowed people to adjust the fact that circumstances are different now than they were then. And that really powerful and brilliant mode of interpretation caused a fundamentalist reaction against him in Pakistan. He came out one day, he told me, I said, why did you leave Pakistan? He said, I came out one day and there were 5,000 people outside my balcony calling for my death. And so he was driven out of Pakistan by fundamentalists because he was a reformer and an opponent of fundamentalists and the kind of things that they most fear. He was offered asylum in the United States. He studied in Oxford, got his PhD, and learned Greek and Arabic, did magnificent work on Greek and Arabic thought, and trained a generation of Islamic scholars, many of whom have gone back to Malaysia and Indonesia and other places and have brought the same kind of view of openness. Whatever their particular opinions and views, that's a sense of absolute openness that he had and gentleness. And so if one gets so angry or so categorical and that one starts making quick judgments like V.S. Naipaul, calling Fazlur Rahman a fundamentalist fanatic, the danger is that in the wake of September 11th, where everybody's worried about who's going to get a visa, and why are these people getting visas, these terrorists? Well, you know, what's going to happen is the Fazlur Rahmans are going to be denied the visas, and the terrorists are still going to find ways to get in. So it's an absolute travesty and a catastrophe to make these categorical judgments. It's self-destructive in the most powerful way. And the best thing that can possibly happen in the next 10 years is for there to be this kind of program that was announced tonight on a massive scale. It's just vital. I've had Islamic leaders call me up from Kosovo and Sarajevo and say, we desperately need educational opportunities for our young Muslim children. Our schools have been destroyed as they were in Afghanistan. They have no opportunity. The fundamentalists come. They have billions of dollars in Saudi money. They give them scholarships to go to study with fundamentalist madrasas and to train in Arabic and become fundamentalist imams. Those fundamentalist imams are then sent around the world. And what we need are people to come and study in the West, to get to know the West, to study Christianity and Judaism and Islam, And to study Islam, religion in the way that Muslim and non-Muslim students study with Fazlur Rahman. And more Fazlur Rahman courses would be the most powerful antidote to the kind of vicious madrasa teaching that's going on in some of these extremist schools. So these are some brief thoughts, and I've covered a lot of territory. I hope I provoke some questions. We can have a good discussion. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, I had a question or a comment to suggest that you're working within the artificial framework, which you're criticizing, and your critique should be far more radical. And the critique begins with the assertion that there is no such thing as the West. And what you have instead is a scriptural tradition interpreted through Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, augmented with the Hellenistic traditions and philosophy. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
As the leading paradigm, and it's a much more powerful paradigm than the alternatives that we're stuck with in terms of popular media.
Yeah, I think you have a very, very good point. In many ways, the term the West is by itself oppositional. It implies an East, and for a while the Soviet Union and Soviet communism were that East. That's gone. We need an East if there's a West. So then Islam becomes the East. And by definition, the East is in opposition to the West. And so it's a conflictual category by its very nature. There's been great work done by Thomas Musnak and others showing that actually the concept of Europe came about. Europe was a vague mythological figure up until the mid-15th century. And then it was war with the Turks that got the concept of Europe going. And many of the people that invented Europe as a concept said that we define ourselves by war with the Turks. So in some sense, there you have these conflictual categories that get embedded in the language and that have the seeds of the very problems that we're trying to discuss. And your point, I think, is also valid in the sense that, and I tried to allude to that a little bit, that even if one accepted there's what Marshall Hodgson called Christendom, the area that was largely ruled by Christianity, and Islamdom, the area that's largely ruled by Islam, and Judaism and Christianity within those areas, depending, could be in one or the other cultural worlds. Even if one accepts that approach, if one goes back to the Middle Ages and one finds that so much of what we call Christendom, medieval Europe, was bound up with the Arabs and the Muslims in profound ways that have since been censored, that or ethnically cleansed out of traditions through nationalist scholarship over the centuries. You're absolutely right. And the question is, I'd like this ultimately to be part of a public debate. And I would like these points to be raised. And so when someone like Bernard Lewis comes on and makes the points he does, there could be an alternate voice. And on some level, if you say the alternate voice is a voice that fundamentally deconstructs all these categories, I can't find a way that it could reach an audience outside the classroom or the college, but there may be a way of doing it, and I'd love to talk to you further about that. Yes? Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Absolutely. That's why the Taliban destroyed the manuscripts and smashed the musical instruments and threw the poets in jail. I mean, there's no doubt. I'm not saying that all Muslims are in favor of poetry. I'm just saying it's a powerful aspect of culture, and it's one that is, in fact, a threat to fundamentalism, and therefore it's going to be shut down by fundamentalists if they can possibly do it. Yes. Well, let me take your first question first about the problem of names. That's why I study apophatic mysticism. Apophatic mysticism believes that any name you use has a deep inherent problem in it, and especially if you're using it about something powerful like the beloved or God or cultures, that you have to talk about things. You have to choose a name. If you choose the name Mediterranean culture, there's all problems with that. I mean, what about Iran? I mean, Afghanistan's up, is that Mediterranean? So no matter what name you choose, you're carving things up. And language carves things up into categories. And what apophatic thinkers do is they look at religious traditions and they say, why is everybody arguing with each other and dismissing each other's truths and calling each other's heretics? And so Ibn Arabi has this beautiful apophatic philosophy that, people have to use names, so we each use a name and a language, and that becomes a kind of prism through which we see reality. And someone else has a different language or cultural system or naming system. We see the image of God, not as God is in God's self, but as that image is refracted into a particular form by the names we use. And then we see that the image that they have is different, because every human being has a different way of naming things on some level. And then we say, oh, that guy, God can't be with that guy's belief, it's with my belief. And then you get into the thing that, you know, I possess the true belief and that they don't. And Ibn Arabi says, you know, of course God is everywhere, can't be possessed. The love poets stress that you can never possess the beloved. It's the primary power of the love poetry, the sense of infinite non-closure, infinite non-ultimate naming. And so I think that you're absolutely right, that, but I don't think you can just find a better name. I think what it needs is whatever name we start out with, whether it's the Mediterranean or the Middle East, or none of these names are good, but because someone's always wrongly excluded from those terms. So whatever name we start out with, we have the kind of thinking that you and John did. That, well, there's something wrong with that. And that's built in, you expect that, and it should happen. And if it doesn't, you're disappointed, because without that, then things freeze into these categories. And apophatic thinking has this extraordinary tradition in world thought, and I think it could be brought to bear on this, and to find ways to bring, how to find ways to bring it in, and I was mentioning, to these more, to the public debate. And if you're in a public debate, and you're an apophatic thinker, and someone's making all these categorical points that seem impressive, and you're on one of these TV shows where you have to say something fast or quick or they throw you off the air, and television is powerful, and you got, the question is, what, the apophatic mystics have had enormous influence in the world. It's been a subtle influence. It's not been a kind of stand-up debating influence. To the extent that they stood up and debated people, they usually got in trouble. But it's a deep question. I just have to say that I agree with you profoundly on it. As far as your third question on the inadequacy of the names I'm using, as far as your third question about the Quran, I think part of the problem here is people like Fazlur Rahman wanted to get to those kind of questions. But there's a tradition in Western scholarship going back to the colonial period, missionary polemic, that that's tried to show that the Quran is not genuine and that it's a fake. And so that there's a kind of, and a lot of these kind of thinkings, the way these questions have been raised by many people in the, quote, West, unquote, in the former colonial countries. And people have heard this coming from British and French scholars, and they've seen how it was used in bad faith. And it might be used in a good faith now to kind of question our very assumptions about what origins are and what definitions are of the sacred text itself. But I think that because of part of that history, and because of the kind of thing that Bernard Lewis says about the Quran, which reinforces those feelings, that there's this group in the West that really want us to kind of, or this group in the quote West, unquote, that really want us to kind of give up the very foundation of what is important to us and kind of lose it like some societies have lost any sense of religiosity. So there's a kind of resistance to some of the questions you're asking. And I think people like Sarush are really important because they're moving in that direction, or at least in a direction that will be from the Quranic tradition itself, perhaps a new way of asking a similar question. Yes?
Can I ask you, it's very difficult to imagine apophatic politics.
Right. Right.
Metaphysics, if you will.
Yeah.
With the fact that we are into an enormously oppositional political situation. I mean, you
yes.
mentioned about Iraq. Whatever Dick Cheney is up to, it isn't very promising for what's going to happen to Iraq.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm interested how this more inclusive, non-oppositional sort of thing, how this plays out politically.
Well,
how does this work from your point of view politically?
Well, let me give you my own experience where I was most involved in politics. I got involved in the Bosnia issue. And there, the oppositional categories were, these people are in the Balkans. They're different than us. They have age-old antagonisms. They're used to killing one another. In fact, putting one another in concentration camps and exterminating each other is part of their culture. It would be cultural imperialism on our part to evoke the genocide clause of the UN ban on genocide and to go in and intervene and stop that genocide. So you had these fixed, absolutely fixed notions of them and us. In fact, the whole notion of the Serb, the Croat, the Muslim, when one looks at the reality in the former Yugoslavia, a lot of people didn't know they were Muslims or Serbs in that sense. They thought of themselves as in many different ways. And what the nationalists do is they try to make their premise, which is that we are Serbs and they are Croats or they are Muslims, the reality. And the more violence they use, the more polarization they cause, and the more other people start to feel that way. If you're being persecuted for being X, sooner or later you're starting to say, okay, all of X must rise up and defend ourselves. And so so when I wrote this book, The Bridge Betrayed, I was trying to talk about how Serbian religious nationalists used this religious mythology with the help of the bishops and the priests, right down to the level of the atrocities at the village level, and everything was put into this mythology. But I tried never to use the term the Serbs, never to use the term the Croats, and I after the book became read and, at one point, there was even an article in the Washington Post that President Clinton read it, and it influenced some speech. And I thought, well, at least, somebody read it. The point I'm trying to make is, even when I started getting called by reporters to talk on interview shows, they would say, "Well, what do you say about the Serbs?" And I said, "What Serbs? And I was always trying to break down those categories, and. So I think on some level it's a never-ending process. I wish I had a better way of doing it. There's Svetlana Broz, who's the granddaughter of Tito, has a Garden of Remembrance in Sarajevo, and she's written a book that's going to come out in English called Good People in Evil Times. And it's about all the people in Bosnia who saved the lives of people that were the other, quote unquote, in these fixed categories. And when they tell their stories, they are very good at breaking down these categories. And so it's not about Croats who saved the lives of Serbs and Serbs who saved the lives of Croats. It's about good people in evil times who resisted those fixed kind of categories even as they were going through extraordinary persecution. And I think that those stories, I think that kind of story, I think is one important compelling image. Yes?
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking about a curve, if you look at former Yugoslavia, which is the area I know well, all areas of former Yugoslavia, there was a less linear goal-oriented attitude.
Sure.
Yeah. It's just that in Bosnia, there was at least a goal-oriented attitude toward time, and it was also in Bosnia that you had the most rural, least industrialized segment of the population. And I'm wondering, you know, when you talk about the fact that the Taliban is associated with medieval kinds of thoughts, as erroneous as that is, if we aren't just talking about what we've heard discussed in the media, that opposition, a traditional versus modern or postmodern way of living, and that when you see this opposition between Islam and Christianity and Judaism, you aren't just seeing the ways in which those confessions are represented by either more traditional, rural, less industrialized people versus more urban, cosmopolitan. And I think of investigation of Trier, where on herbicide and what Donovan did in Yugoslavia, where that was the most important distinction.
I think that there are certainly a sense of traditional cultures being threatened by these larger forces. I don't know if part of your question was going to get at what I'm talking about. But some people have said that really this is a war against, you know, of the countryside and the mountains against the city, and I really think that's a mistake. The people that actually carried out and organized the genocide and the shelling of Sarajevo were Sarajevans. All the people that, some of the people that were enlisted into the militias to do the dirty work were people from the countryside, but it was sophisticated urban elites that organized these genocides against Sarajevo and that adopted this idea that Sarajevo was filthy because people contact one another across religions and there's all this promiscuity and religious promiscuity and wanted to annihilate it. Basically, they spent their life living this culture. They knew where all its cultural sites were, so they were able to target them with their shelling and destroy libraries and other cultural treasures. So, and there's this wonderful story of Ivan Lovrenovic, where there was an artist in Sarajevo when the Serb militia took one, when a Serb nationalist militia took one district. And the officer went up and found the artist and was looking around, and he saw that, like many Bosnians, his art was filled with representations from Christianity, Islam, and Judaism all mixed together. And he saw that, and he saw that there was some Arabic calligraphy in one of his artworks, and he became outraged. He had the art taken down to the street, propped up, and he had it machine gunned. He executed the art. Because, and I thought that, you know, the symbolism of that was extraordinary. But again, two things. One, certainly this is not simply Islamic. This issue of time and getting out of transactional time exists everywhere. I mean, it exists where I grew up in Anaconda, Montana, where everybody was saying, oh, in the good old days, we knew our neighbors, we talked to people. And it's true, now there's a strip street where we had this wonderful neighborhood. But for some reason, and I think it's really important to acknowledge the political reality, that Islam is an internationally diverse and complex, but still somehow cohesive world is really, in the wake of the Cold War, taking on a kind of default kind of opposition to all the kind of things that, you know, people are claiming is the triumph of global capitalism and its values. And it's just, I think it's a reality that it's been politicized in that fact, in that way. So when people like Bernard Lewis write a book and they say the problem with Muslims, they don't wear watches, and he goes into this historical thing, and I think it's important to acknowledge, to argue the case, and to say, okay, you know, to argue the case, you have to at least stipulate someone's language a little bit. And so you stipulate someone's language, and then, but if you don't argue the case, if you don't say, okay, it's true about the clocks in some of those situations, and actually see the truth in some of the things he says, then you can never really overcome the ideology and the way that he manipulates it. Otherwise, I don't think. I mean, and the thing about apophasis is there's never a pure apophasis. There's never a pure language of non-naming. All language has to name at some point. So I don't think Islamic or Middle East or anything are good for this notion of the defense of transactional time. But what I'm trying to say is that because of the Islamic calendar, because of the call to prayer, because this is a universal situation, because Muslims are coming into confrontation with various societies on these issues about, you know, what do you do for the call to prayer? Some people find it weird that people kind of disappear for a minute. Some people find it threatening that people would carry out their prayers in public in a place that, you know, that's supposed to be a secular culture. All of these things have been kind of on some level gotten associated with Islamic calendars and practices and situations. So on some level, I think it's related to understanding some of the things that are Islamophobic about the polemic behind the clash theorists and responding to them. Yes, back there. You're absolutely right, and the fact that that V.S. Naipaul, who argues that all non-Arab Muslim cultures are authentic, are essentially inauthentic, and out of their deep insecurities are based on bad faith, this is a ludicrous argument. I mean, I won't go into it, how silly it is, but if you could imagine someone saying all non-Aramaic Christian cultures are inauthentic. But the point I'm trying to make is, this is the problem. That is that when there's a politicized reality in who gets chosen to be on the talk shows, who gets chosen to come to Congress, who gets chosen to be given an award like the Nobel Prize at a very extraordinary moment 2 weeks after September 11th and be cited for having the most profound insight on Islam, and it's these people. And so there's an element there of simple, hardcore political critique. I work on culture and poetry and things, and there are probably people who know about structural political critique better than I do. But it's amazing to find out there was a review of Bernard Lewis in the New York Times. I thought a guy was talking about God. You know, this is the greatest scholar in the 20th century. Nobody listens to his views, and they've all been wrong. Look, he's been validated. Here is his new book, went wrong. It's the most brilliant thing. Everybody should read it. And of course, he gets it onto the best-selling list. He goes on Charlie Rose. Charlie Rose is saying, you know, you're just a treasure. There's nothing like you. You're the oracle. You know, and I'm saying, whoa, you know, it is true that Bernard Lewis knows some language, and he wrote a book on the assassins 40 years ago, which has some scholarly merit, and he's been writing some polemics since, and he's a very popular figure. But, you know, when people say, He is the only real scholar of Islam in the Western world, and that's the point they're trying to make. You have to ask, what is going on here underneath that? And when Naipaul is awarded the Nobel Prize, I mean, and throughout his work on the Nobel Prize, Naipaul's also been supporting the VHP in India that's been causing these kind of horrors there. So that deep structural political issue is one that your question is far more profound than any possible answer I could come up with. That's fine. Well, just say that I'll be around here if people want to talk. Oh, let me say one thing.
Sure.
Oh, one other thing. One small thing I've tried to do is I passed around this list of resources. There are resources that I find that people who aren't in a structured class situation, who want to get introduced into some of these things, have found really valuable. Everybody has their own set of resources. There is a new edition of the Bulletin of the American Academy of Religion that has five suggestions by five professors of Islamic studies. But I think that this is my little way of trying to offer some alternative to people saying, you want to know about Islam, go read Bernard Lewis. Thanks.
Being somewhat prone myself to Middle Eastern or Mediterranean or Montana time, I might have let this go on because I was enjoying it so much, but I think it makes sense to formally call a halt. Michael mentioned that he'd be standing around here.
Sitting around.
Thank you, I found it enormously helpful.
It's always hard to talk about everything, you know, you're leaving all things out, but I try, you know, I find in these public events it's fun to generate the conversation. So.
Sure, I wish I did a little. Is it a dot, not flash?
Oh, yeah.
Over there, okay.
Oh, okay, yeah. All right, thank you.
Yeah. I just want to thank you, and I look forward to hearing about the Afrofascism. This was wonderfully interesting. Thank you very much.
Thanks. It's really great to see you. And good meeting you.